I'm Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning. Today we've got the liberal agenda coming up this hour, plus the latest on the campaign. Kerry goes positive while Bush continues going negative. Hey, where else is he going to go, right? But right now I'm joined by Mark Riley and the slightly ailing Sue Ellicott. How are you feeling, Sue?
Fighting the good fight.
Oh, good for you.
There you go.
Good for you. She's on the air.
It's amazing the power of honey chamomile tea.
Oh, God, I hope it works out.
Plus ibuprofen.
Oh, good.
It's the herbal conventional medicine mix. You know, if you don't know what to do, just do it all.
And I hope you feel better. And that is also, that's equally matched with my concern for getting sick. I'm not an all-out nurturer, but I hope you feel better.
Yeah, I like being in this bubble with the gauze mask that you've put me in over here in the corner.
Yeah, that's right.
I can just reach my finger out and just about grab my pen.
We're bringing the guys. It's going to seal you in a box over there.
In fact, I'm in a different office in a different part of Manhattan, and I'm using an ISDN link because they refuse to breed my germs.
Uh-oh. Yeah, you're giving away all the secrets. We're going to try and pull it off, but that's right. Sue is now coming to us from a...
South of France.
Lucky
that's
Sue.
My first choice.
Lucky Sue is in the south of France, so I'm sorry you're sick, and we'll try not to. I'll try not to aggravate you, if that's possible.
Hey, I'll act sick every day.
See,
that would destroy the whole dynamic.
Okay, that's right. All right.
Weird, contentious, mean thing that we have going. People out there are believing it. They don't realize that you and I are best friends.
That's right.
We're married.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Oh, that'll be a surprise to my wife.
All right. Yeah, my husband.
Don't worry. To other people. Yeah.
He's in town, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Uh-oh. He's still in town?
He's still in town.
Oh, thank God. So he's got some
around.
Nurturing. She came in sick today. I'm like, uh-oh, who's going to help Sue out? Now I know your husband's.
She's just got 2 hours and change left in her
husband.
She'll
go back and he'll climb back into bed. He'll make you some warm tea. Does he
that's
do that?
Him. Yes, he probably would, actually.
Oh, that's very nice. Wow.
He got up yesterday to lock the door behind me.
That's not about you.
No, it's not about me. It's about the bizarre locking system of the apartment.
Oh, really?
I'm going to get up, honey, at 3 o'clock, and the bad news is you have to get up too, because until you cut a second set of keys, you have to lock the downstairs second inside door. There's 3 keys to get into my apartment.
Uh-oh.
My wife will sleep through anything. She won't get up ever.
Really?
Oh, man, it's unbelievable. There could be an earthquake in Los Angeles, and she'd be like, what happened?
Good for her.
So it looks like very interesting news today. You know, I watched the press conference in the middle of the night.
The Brahimi press conference.
I watched in Arabic, which made it very compelling. I understood nothing, but it was very interesting.
Was it on Al Jazeera or something?
No, it was on CNN, but they were translating it.
Oh,
but
okay.
I tried just to listen to the Arabic because I wanted to have the full impact.
I have this theory that helps, actually. If you don't speak a foreign language and you watch somebody talking, you have a much better sense of whether they're actually telling the truth and whether they're being genuine, just looking at their body language and their facial expressions, even if you have no clue what they're saying.
I think that's probably true. The weird thing is I was in this sort of this fantasy interim government league. And my first draft pick was Pachachi, and he's out. But, you know, I'm going to stick with him.
That sounds more like the Dream Diary.
You know, I'll tell you, I kind of wonder sometimes. When I see translated stuff, I always wonder if they're not, you know, mistranslating on purpose. I'm getting to be like you.
That's the thing. It's like I was thinking about that too when I was listening to the translator translate him. Like, that's going to be the guy that's going to have to deliver the worst news for the world is the guy translating the Arabic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he's got to get it right. You know, and they're very quick. You know, he's just going, I've chosen a government. I'm not sure
wonderful?
If it's the right thing. I don't really know these people. They were recommended to me by shady sources. And then he's like, get off! Put the real guy in!
You know you're being misled when someone says, no, were you pleased with the selection, Mr. Brahimi? And you hear like,
yes.
It shows and says, yes.
Yes, very pleased, exactly. Like bad translations to Asian movies.
Yeah, right. You know, there's a question if there's a new scandal getting ready to plague the Bush administration this morning. And it's not with Brahimi, and it's not with, not directly with Iraq. There are calls today from congressional Democrats for an investigation into just how much input Vice President Dick Cheney had in awarding those no-bid contracts to his former employer, Halliburton. We talked a bit about this yesterday, about that email that
the email that said that we've got it all, you're in.
Yeah. Is that? Yeah, that email.
But the Halliburton email. Didn't even bid. Didn't they just get awarded the contract?
No, it was a no bid contract. Right. There were no bidding involved.
Oh,
here.
No bid. I thought it said no big. That's why I was completely
No bid.
Sorry. And years are going.
Of course, this is the in the wake of that email that was reported by Time Magazine, and it seemed to provide at any rate, a direct link between the vice president and those contracts for rebuilding Iraq. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, friend of the room, says that the email contradicts Cheney's previous assertions that he had nothing to do with the Halliburton deals.
You know, the weird thing is like everyone knows this already, that Dick Cheney's dirty with this stuff, and he has been. I mean, how could he not be? He was chief executive officer of Halliburton from 95 to 2000. So any, you know, I mean, he's clearly guilty is what I'm saying. Of course he...
No, his presidency means nothing.
But the way they'll defend it is like Halliburton was the best contractor for the job. We just knew that. There was no reason to ask anybody else. But he's clearly, I mean, it's all devious. It has been from the top, from the beginning. I just hope they find a way to really implicate this guy and make it stick. Nothing.
It seems like it's Teflon with him. I mean, look, this is a guy who was head of the vice presidential selection committee and selected himself. Is it that great a leap to think? Yeah, that when it came to rebuilding Iraq, that he'd only want Halliburton to be the ones that did it?
Well, I think the probe is definitely in line then. I think they should definitely probe them. And they should also – I was under the – I heard that all the Senate committees, all the catering is actually contracted out to Halliburton, so that's going to cut some.
You mean the Senate committee?
Yeah, all the catering in Washington.
I'll have five tuna wraps, please. Can you get somebody from Halliburton?
That'll be $900.
Yeah, right.
It does seem very hard for him to argue whatever firewalls there are between his making decisions and being in the White House, that he has nothing, that he has no influence at all, when he was still got one of his payments from Halliburton last year for $170,000+. So
that was just a reimbursement for travel.
It was something that he was due, and this happens so often in government that people have all these connections, and it's definitely very seriously wrong in the Bush administration. Anybody who had big money ties to the oil industry, I mean, look at the energy policy. Exactly. One of the most tainted administrations when it comes to ties to big oil industry.
And energy policy,
and oil.
I mean, Enron is almost single-handedly responsible for almost bankrupting California. I mean, and they can't even get the transcripts of that meeting out and legal, and Cheney's protecting that. Cheney is the most secretive bastard on the whole damn thing.
Well, here's the problem. There have been calls from at least two quarters, Senator Patrick Leahy's office and our good friend Senator Frank Lautenberg.
Yeah.
Both of them want the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee to subpoena the emails and any other evidence regarding those contracts with Halliburton, and that is for the rebuilding of Iraq. The chair of the committee is Republican Senator Susan Collins, who says the probe is unnecessary. They say they have enough stuff, enough investigations.
Let's give her phone number out. Call her.
Yeah.
Tell her.
Call Senator Collins' office at 202-224-2523. That's 202-224-2523. Or you can call the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs. They have an office at 202-224-4751. You should give them a call and tell them, look, let's find out what's going on here.
Let's bend him over and probe him.
Now
the old people being like, he's filthy.
Yeah.
I've been a liberal for 900 years, and that's not the radio show. That boy is filthy. I don't like it. We'll be back with the President's Palm Pilot. Plus, decide for yourself what you think of the new John Kerry ad right here on Air America Radio. Past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. I'm here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott.
Hey.
You're listening to Air America Radio. Dick Cheney in the news on the hot seat, hopefully being probed for Halliburton connections the only contract to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure. And there's been an email released that claims that Cheney sort of greased the machinery
the wheels.
To get that kind of email said, we've got it all, you're in.
Through Douglas Feith.
That's code. Feith. That's code, by the way.
Yes.
That's code for it's all ours again. But Cheney also was speaking the other day and took some shots at our boy Kerry.
He's a designated attack dog of the Bush administration, and specifically the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign.
They figure, why not let Dick do it? Because he's the most evil of all of us.
Yes.
And he seems to frighten people, and his heart has been replaced by a strange robotic mechanism.
He's a one-man coalition of the willing when it comes to attacking John Kerry.
What are people like? It's like, it's amazing what these guys can absorb. I hope it stops soon. You know, it's like, it's almost as if we're so used to Dick Cheney being this, you know, demonic neocon, you know, loudmouth, that it just seems people are like, yeah, that's Dick. Even liberals are like, yeah, it's Dick.
Hey, Dick, want to talk about Chalabi, Dick?
Yeah, yeah. What about Chalabi?
Let's talk about him.
The Iranian spy who we believed and went to war on his word. But let's listen to Cheney take a shot at Kerry here.
The Patriot Act has been crucial to many of our successes. Yet Senator Kerry has chosen this moment after these victories to share his second thoughts on the Patriot Act.
Dude, that does not sound very convincing. I have to tell you, Cheney, he actually seemed like he had a little doubt in his voice. Apparently, the mechanical pump in his chest was not connected to the commitment necessary to make that sound like he believed what he was saying. Because the Patriot Act, what Kerry is saying, is not unlike some Republicans are saying, is that it's a little too much. It gives them a little too much freedom to do whatever they want and probe into any parts of our life that they want. And I think that Kerry, I know that Kerry, just says that modifications in the Patriot Act should include, you know, strengthen terrorism laws at work, including sharing information with local law enforcement. Stop unreasonable sneak and peek searches. They can't just sneak and peek everybody because, as I've said before, right now it's terrorism, but when it becomes sort of, you know, chronic porn viewing and they start putting those people into camps, I think there's going to be very few people working any jobs in this country. Now, I'm not saying porn is a good thing, but it happens. Porn happens. Yes, too.
And it's definitely a problem when you have the vice president suggesting that there really cannot be no second thoughts on something as dramatic and influential, really, in public life as the Patriot Act when it's coming up for renewal. There are lots of gray areas where you know. Lawyers and civil libertarians will argue, you know, did we go too far? Didn't we? How do we balance safety with personal liberty? I mean, there have to be second, third, fourth thoughts. Everybody has to look at this and be informed about this. And I don't think that it's really unreasonable to suggest that Kerry reflecting on the Patriot Act is out of line.
Yeah, but there are other people too, and there are Republicans, because, you know, when you talk about, you know, amending the Constitution or distorting it in these ways, you know, this is something that has to exist. It's going to be around for generations, you know, after these people, you know, pass on, that, you know, that could lead to tyranny and destroy the Constitution completely. But former Georgia Congressman and Republican ex-prosecutor Bob Barr is on board with these changes. Eagle Forum President Phyllis Schlafly on board with the changes. Free Congress Foundation President Paul Weyrich on board. Former Virginia Governor James Gilmore. Senator Larry Craig, Republican out of Idaho. All these people agree with Kerry.
But see, here's what you got to do when you deal with Dick Cheney. You have to listen very closely to what he actually is saying. And there's a point. Chris, can we play that sound one more time? Because there's something there that we ought to ask ourselves. Right at the beginning, as a matter.
The Patriot Act has been crucial to many of our successes.
That's it.
Senator
right
Kerry,
there. Right there. That's crucial to our successes.
Can I hit one?
Yes, but he doesn't blame them,
successes?
Does he? Because we don't believe there have been any.
What successes have there been?
Right.
Crucial to our successes. Okay, well, since you said that, let's hear a chronicle of the successes that have come as a direct result of the Patriot Act.
Well, I think he claimed that there were some sort of 300 or so suspects taken into custody. I mean, he did claim some stuff. I have to find out.
Have they been tried and convicted of anything? Any of them?
No.
Have any of them, you know, faced actual charges? Are they all enemy combatants?
No, Mark, they haven't. They haven't.
All
right.
All right. Well,
but it's interesting that they say this at the on the same day that they're pushing the information that Jose Padilla, who is being
that
held,
dirty bomber,
right, that has been is being held still without trial, mm-hmm. and is one of the cases being considered by the Supreme Court as to whether the Patriot Act overreached. That he was intending to blow up apartment buildings and hotels by using
gas.
Yeah, natural gas.
Yeah, turn the gas on and all of the pilot lights and all of the stoves and light a match
exactly.
and kaboom.
So what they're trying to do is kind of undermine any support Jose Padilla had from civil libertarians or people who thought that he's been kind of unfairly treated according to the law by saying, he really was a monster. He really was dangerous. You guys who are living in apartment buildings in Chicago and New York and anywhere that has high-rise living, we've done you a favor here.
So that's his success? Jose Padilla is the extent of the success of the... I'm really trying to get a handle on it.
It's spin, isn't it? It's just language. If you mention success, just the word success, you're supposed to make people believe that you actually had one.
Well, they did. They took a lot of... they detained a lot of people. They have not proven anything with those people, but they certainly deported and detained a lot of people, based on the Patriot Act. But that doesn't make it right, because none of those people have representation. None of those people are being denied habeas corpus. They're denied everything.
I got two words. Brandon Mayfield. Anybody remember him?
Yeah.
From just last week. Was he one of the successes, too?
Right.
The guy that they detained for, 17 days?
Yeah.
Because they said he had something to do with Madrid, and it turned out that they misread his fingerprints?
No.
Was that a success?
No. It gives them complete opportunity to round up anybody they want for any reason at any time. So it's completely not a success. What he's talking about as success is the amazing ability for the government within this country to just go take prisoners whenever they feel like it. That's
like
a success to this guy.
But the counter side to all of that is that when Cheney comes out with that kind of comment, it just accentuates Kerry's own positive theme as he's campaigning, and he's out in those what are considered to be kind of
Virginia.
Bush states.
Yeah.
Yes, Virginia, spending time in a state that the Democrats don't really think is theirs, making remarks on how to make the country safer by securing nuclear arms, by he's pledging to cancel research on a new line of nuclear weapons programs. He's targeting those as the big issues, the things that really make the United States unsafe. And I think he comes out looking good and positive, and as if he really is thinking about matters and not just being very reactive as Cheney is.
We have the new ad. You want to hear it?
Sure.
I do.
We are a country of the future. We're a country of optimists. We're the can-do people.
For John Kerry, a stronger America begins at home. Real plans to create jobs here, not overseas. Lower health care costs. Independence from Middle East oil. And in the world, a strong military and strong alliances to defeat terror. America. Stronger at home. Respected in the world. John Kerry for president.
I'm John Kerry, and I approve this message.
Yay! We are a country of optimists, but me not so much. I'm trying to be optimistic, but I guess you can't really run an ad that says, we are a country of cynics and brooding malcontents.
Well, you could, but you wouldn't get elected.
But he's definitely taking the high road, and I think that in the long run, being positive is going to give him a certain integrity with people.
I think this he's onto something with this Middle Eastern oil thing. We're hearing virtually on a daily basis about the cost of gas, the average price of gas going up and up and up, hitting new records. And I think that whole Middle Eastern oil thing is going to resound with the American people, unless, of course, your boy Prince Bandar comes through.
Yeah, and also the thing about Kerry is he actually has a real political record.
Yeah.
He's been in Congress, or he's been a senator for years. He's actually been part of the process. He can go to his record, whereas Bush, what has Bush got? He was governor, and he owned a baseball team.
But one of the best things about that campaign ad, and Kerry will get better and better at this, I think, is sticking to a simple message. And that's what the electorate responds to best in the United States. It's what Bush has had the upper hand in doing so far. And that stronger at home, respected in the world, two important points, very simple. I think he should stick with it. Good.
Also he's got to find the slogan. What's the new slogan?
Let America be America again.
He's trying that one. What happened to Bush sucks?
Langston Hughes didn't write that.
That was after Labor Day.
No song.
That was an Allen Ginsberg riff, I think, if he were still alive.
Wow. Coming up, the presidential palm pilot. Bush flip-flops again, plus your phone calls and the all-important liberal agenda. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I am Mark Maron. I'm with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. Today,
hello.
It's Wednesday, and my buddy in the Oval Office, who picks up after the president, the toys that he leaves around. He also taps into and hacks into the presidential palm pilot, and I've got the president scheduled for today, Wednesday, June 2nd, 8 a.m. Wake up, 28 days to Iraq handover, a.k.a. Operation Not My Problem. 9 a.m., respond to Kerry's plan to fight nuclear terrorism without having to say the word nuclear. Sorry, I mean nuclear. Nuclear. Damn. 9:30 a.m., fly to Colorado. Remember, high altitude makes you lightheaded. Cool. 11:05 a.m., give commencement address at Air Force Academy. Very important. Do not wear flight suit or helmet. 12:30 p.m., chat with Air Force Academy graduates. Subjects to avoid: Texas Air National Guard Service, Iraq, Texas Air National Guard Service, the economy, Texas Air National Guard Service. 2 p.m., prep for weekend trip to Italy. Try to remember, when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's, what is that called? There's a word for it. 6 p.m., prep for meeting with Pope. Learn some useful phrases in Popish. 9 p.m., call new president of Iraq after 9 o'clock. Don't waste daytime minutes. 9:50 p.m., put on flight suit. 9:50 p.m., put on flight suit and helmet. Gaze wistfully into the mirror. Give self thumbs up. 10 p.m., lights out. 10:01 p.m., lights on. Take off helmet. 10:02 p.m., lights out. There you go. It's the president's schedule, and it was a good one.
At least no meetings with Ramon lately.
No, Ramon's out for the time being.
Yeah, he's still under arrest, is he?
Yeah, until he's needed. You just keep criminals on the on the back burner until you need them. Yeah, then you make them ambassadors and vice presidents.
Well, speaking of which, as you mentioned in the briefing, there's a new government in Iraq. Thanks or no thanks to our president, and a new timetable for the withdrawal of coalition forces from the country. Both of the result of changes in policy previously stated by both the Bush administration and Britain. The American choice for president took himself out of the running. That would be Pachachi.
I have my
Pachachi.
There goes $50 I lost.
Yeah, right. And a compromise saw Ghazi Yawar, a critic of the U.S. occupation, sworn in. And by the way, this was...
It's critic yesterday. In quotations?
Yeah. No, well,
a critic.
Critic, yeah. And he wears traditional garb, too, by the way. This followed a tense weekend of negotiating that led the U.S. Coalition to kind of back down on their... It was just the other day, Paul Bremer said, look, if you choose Yawar, we're not buying it.
That's right. Vote again. Yeah. Maybe you didn't understand.
Vote until you get it right.
Yeah.
At the same time, the U.S. and Britain have showed some flexibility in revising their U.N. resolution on Iraq. They've actually set a timetable for coalition forces to leave, something that the original draft did not contain. There's no hard and fast date, however, but the new text says troops will withdraw when a new elected government takes office. That change was meant to speak to objections by China, France, Germany, Russia, among others, that there was no timetable. Still to be resolved is the question of whether the Iraqi military can refuse to take part in a military operation.
This also signifies, Mark, the amazing first ever, I think, triple flip-flop on behalf of the Bush presidency.
Well,
triple.
It is
flip-flop.
It sounds like an ice skating thing. Maybe you should call it a triple salco.
Or diving.
Well, it's more. It could be a baseball thing. Whatever it is, he wins. He is the flip-flop commander-in-chief. And we will go into that after you finish.
Well, let's go into it now. On April 13th, lucky 13 for our president, George W. Bush said the United States will not leave Iraq until the job was finished. Now,
we're not.
A month and a day later, on May 14th, Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq and the guy who got in the middle of all of this back and forth about the new president, said something ever so slightly different.
U.N. Resolution 1511 provides that the coalition forces could stay in Iraq. But as a matter of fact, we don't stay in countries where we're not wanted. So if the provisional government, the interim government, were to ask us to leave, we would leave. We don't stay where we're not wanted.
So he says.
Yeah, and like on April 13th, Bush said, in terms of how long we'll be there, as long as necessary and not one day more. And then May 14th, Bremer, if the provisional government asks us to leave, we will leave.
But wait, there's more.
Yes.
10 days later, on May 24th, this is, of course, during Bush's now famous speech to the Army War College audience, he said something ever so slightly different from what Bremer said.
Commanders had estimated that a troop level below 115,000 would be sufficient at this point in the conflict. Given the recent increase in violence, we'll maintain our troop level at the current 138,000 as long as necessary.
Okay. Well, let's see if they ask us to leave now.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that was, and then...
Well, he's done this now three times. Now the fourth, well, I guess
is
the fourth
a quadruple? No, I guess it would be a triple flip-flop because there was the ground statement. Right. So you have the first statement, then like, huh? And then like, wait, and then uh-huh. So that's three flip-flops.
Yeah, and
how
now...
How dare they!
But...
Now there's another one because he said, now the draft resolution that they've resubmitted, the revised resolution, says that that the coalition troops will in fact leave as soon as the new government, a new elected Iraqi government, takes office.
In my speech to the nation.
Yeah,
that one. Yeah, that's it.
I guess the worst one would be if he announced yet another invasion.
Yeah.
It's just, but
triple flip-flop president. And these guys have the nads to accuse Kerry of flip-flopping because, you know, he's a senator. You know, legislation evolves. It's not always what it starts out to be, so you have to make concessions. That's not flip-flopping. That's being a politician in the job of senator. If it's not the bill that you wanted initially, you make different decisions as it progresses along.
Well, he's also flip-flopped on a couple of other things. You know, the Ahmed Chalabi case.
You mean George Bush, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
The Chalabi case seems not to go away. The FBI is probing whether the head of the Iraqi National Congress told officials in Iran that the U.S. had broken their secret communications code. The Washington Post says Chalabi said he'd been told about the code breaking by a drunken U.S. official. The Bush administration asked the New York Times not to print details of the intercepted message alleging Chalabi's disclosure.
What does that mean? Like after he got drunk with him, something happened?
Yeah,
don't print
don't
the details, the sordid details. Chalabi's sitting there going, have another drink, my American friend, please.
Well, you know, the thing is, this story has been circulating around Washington, apparently, since they raided his house on May 20th.
Where he says he had no classified documents, but he did... This guy is basically an Iranian spy. This guy had the character.
An alleged Iranian.
Yeah, but he had the.
He hasn't been convicted.
He was a two-faced, weird, kind of like spineless guy when we got involved with him. So a convicted embezzler, an Iranian spy, and he says we should go to war with Iraq, and we do.
Yes.
How is that?
No more drinking for U.S. officials in the Middle East.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, really.
How are they going to live with themselves?
That would be that could improve U.S. foreign policy. You'll have to go.
It's just baffling.
Total.
It's baffling. It's I can't even imagine. Like, you know what? Some days I look at this administration, I look at what's happening in the country, and I really have to say, are we living in a science fiction movie? Is this some sort of, is this a joke? I mean, this guy was a spy, an embezzler, a spineless weasel. And he was the reason that we got involved in Iraq. His justification.
Now, in the interest of accuracy, you should call him an alleged spineless weasel.
No, spineless weasel is apparently it's an opinion. It doesn't matter.
I just wanted to make sure. Mark Maron can say that. He may have a spine.
He may have a spine.
Well, physiologically.
Well, he's clearly very, divisive, and he's very, he's a political animal, as they say. And I'm saying that animal is a weasel.
I think he's a hoe for money.
Well, look, we're going to take your calls, okay? What do you think? Do you think that Bush is going to, get out of the woods politically with the Iraq? Is this handover going to turn into a hand-washing? Call us at 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270, sedition at airamericaradio.com. We'll put you on the line. Give us a call at Air America. Good morning. Morning Sedition. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. Please call us. 866-303-AAR0. 866-303-2270. We're asking you about, is Bush out of the woods politically with Iraq? Is it going to slide off him? Is he going to turn the handover into a hand washing? Who do we got, Riley? Who do we got, Sue? Who's blinking up there?
Who's blinking? We have Bob on Long Island.
Bob, how are you?
You certainly do. Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to state that looking historically, there's never been a country that has been taken over militarily, a conquered country, that has gone as well as the Iraq situation has gone. I think we are a bunch of mamby-pambies if we think that everything has to be easy and overdone. But this is a great thing for the world that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power. I think sometimes people are forgetting that.
Bob, can't you just take one pop shot at Bush? We're here to take down the president.
Well, I really can't, because I have to. I do say I do admire his courage.
Come on, Bob. Come on, Chalabi. Come on, Chalabi. The guy's a spy. He's a weasel. We went to war on the assumption there were weapons of mass destruction there. He was lying. Come on, nothing.
Does anybody forget that this is a country, or a Saddam, who tried to kill the president of the United States? If he had been successful doing that, do you think that
we might not be in the mess we're in now?
But if he had killed George Bush Sr., does anybody think that we would not go to war with him and not
remove
him?
Yeah, but he didn't kill George Bush Sr., right?
But he did try to. So does anybody think that...
But wait, wasn't the assumption that he was a threat to America, you know, that he was a direct nuclear threat to America? Wasn't the bill of goods the Americans were sold?
No, they never said he was a direct nuclear threat to America.
Oh, yes, they did.
No, they...
Yes, they did. They said he was producing and had interest in producing weapons of mass destruction, and they knew where they were.
What about the uranium from Nigeria? That turned out to be... Bob, did you call me yesterday about the movie?
No, I did not.
All right.
Well, the fact is that Saddam Hussein was an enemy of the United States. There's no question about that.
All right.
They were shooting at American planes.
Yeah,
does
I understand that. Yeah, but what were the planes doing there to begin
what
with?
What do you think that should be done to a country that shoots at American planes?
Listen,
that are flying over there, flying over them.
What should be? First of all,
and by the way, when you talk about plotting assassinations, that means I assume then that the Cubans should have declared war on America 40 years ago when we tried to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Probably.
Oh, okay. So that would have been cool.
The fact is, Bob, is that
nothing to be cool. But the fact is that had he been successful killing the president, I would hope that at least then people would say that, you know what, this is a regime that needs to be removed.
Yeah,
I don't understand how you draw a line between attempted murder and murder.
Well, there's
a legal line between attempted murder and murder. You don't do the same amount of time.
One, the guy's alive. The other, the guy's dead.
Thank
you for calling, though, Bob. The issue is that we were misled. We were lied to about the reasons we went to war as a country, and now we're in it. And, you know, he's assuming that it's going well because of today and assuming that it's going well because of the way we're occupying this country. But the truth of the matter is the means by which we went there and the number of people that are dying and the situation was all based on a lie that was given to the American people. Skeeter in Vermont. Nice to talk to you again, Skeeter.
Hey, Skeeter.
Yeah, hi, guys.
What's up, buddy?
And if I wanted to shift gears a bit and talk about the Jose Padilla case. I don't know about you, but I find it highly suspicious that the feds would make public its case against Padilla just days before the Supreme Court is due to issue its ruling on the constitutionality of Padilla's detention. Because remember, we're now in June. The court's adjourning for the summer on June 24th, so it has to issue its ruling sometime this month.
Yeah, this administration has an uncanny ability to time reality in their favor, doesn't it?
I saw the Justice Department, a spokesman for the Justice Department, giving a press conference just today, actually, and interesting.
Now, beyond coincidence, right. I think is what Skeeter's trying to say, and I'll agree with him.
Yeah, exactly. And they bring up the so-called, you know, the dirty bomber suspect on the just after Cheney's trying to tell us what great successes they've had fighting terror.
And by the way, the first caller, who was that, Bob?
Yeah.
Yes.
Talking about, you know, Saddam and you know, getting rid of him, and he tried to do this, and wasn't it a net plus? Colin Powell is still trying to get the CIA to explain to him where that faulty intelligence came from that led him to go to the UN and essentially lie to them.
He wants to clean his reputation up so bad, I don't know he's going to get any final word on that.
But yeah. I think this is like a way of thinking that, you know, doesn't matter. You know, if the thing is a success, and this is what Bush is counting on, it doesn't matter why or what we did to get where we are if it works.
I agree.
And that's revisionism, and it's lying, and it's completely manipulative, and it's completely dishonest.
That bastard.
Yeah, that lying bastard. For a president to do that. You know what? We'll keep taking your calls, so why don't you keep calling us at 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. Stay here on Air America Radio. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Elka on Air America Radio. In the next couple of hours, we've got some pretty exciting stuff coming up. We got Howard Dean on the phone. We got Chris Matthews on the phone. And we've got Bishop Gene Robinson going to sit down with us and chit-chat.
In studio.
Please probe Dick Cheney. Cheney demands, we demand that you probe Dick Cheney. Call Senator Collins' office at 202-224-2523. Tell her that you want Cheney probed immediately for Halliburton's connection to the Iraq war in terms of, you know, Cheney greasing that particular probing.
Now, that's Senator Susan Collins of Maine. She is chair of the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs.
Richard in Long Island. It's not going well, is it?
Hello.
Hello, hey. Richard.
How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind, man? You got a little something to say to that other guy?
Well, you know, I mean, to compare, to say that this invasion or takeover of Iraq is going well comparatively to other takeovers, I can't imagine what he's comparing it to.
Yeah, what would that be? This is a good question. I don't know why we didn't pick up on that. Which takeover is he referring to?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't. But, you know, the fact that this whole notion of Saddam Hussein being God, making this whole world a safer place, to me seems quite insane. I have a brother who's a right-winger, and he constantly, every time I back him into a corner, he says also, do you want Saddam Hussein back in power? And, you know, and that's an incomplete question.
Yeah.
He didn't just wave a magic wand and he was gone. If my choice is to have Saddam Hussein back in power, have the 800-plus GIs alive.
Yeah.
1,000 arms and legs sewn back onto the wounded,
yeah.
And have thousands of innocent Iraqis alive, yeah, I'll make that trade.
Yeah, I mean, Saddam was our business partner for years. You know, yeah. He just became a bad business partner. Thanks for your call, Richard. Brian, quickly, what's going on, Brian?
Oh, not much, guys. This guy, Bob Long Island, is an idiot.
Yes.
I cannot believe that. He's talking about how the world is a better place now that Saddam has been caught. See, from what I recall, the guy who allegedly masterminded the takedown of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was not Saddam Hussein, but an Osama bin Laden.
Yes.
Who was the most wanted man in the world, according to George Bush, on September 13th of 2001. But 6 months later, on March 13th, 2002, Bush is quoted as saying, I don't know where bin Laden is. I have no idea and really don't care.
Exactly.
It's not
exactly.
That important. It's not our priority.
Exactly. And the world, and there's been more terrorist activity since 9/11. He has not been, you know, he has not stopped terrorism in any way. He's only made it worse. Iraq is now a terrorist manufacturing plant. Thanks for your call. You're absolutely right on the money. And now shifting gears into the funny, that's today's liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Thank you, callers. Here it is. Get your notebooks and your pens. One, call Julia Roberts. Register her unborn twins as Democrats. Two, demand that D-Day ceremonies include women and gays. Three, offer acupuncture to terrorists suffering from missile launcher shoulder strain. Four, be sure to visit new Disney attraction. Barbara Streisand's It's a Small World controlled by oil companies and big business interests after all. Five, remake Knight Rider with special gay nonviolent hybrid car. Do what you will. Those were good ones. Those are good ones.
I think
you should take action on that and call Senator Collins' office, 202-224-2523.
Give her a jingle.
Cheney needs to be probed.
There's much more to come on today's Morning's Edition. Openly gay Episcopal Bishop Eugene Robinson joins us in studio, plus Mark Maron's Dream Diary and Recovery Corner, and later, former Vermont Governor Dr. Howard Dean. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here along with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, Wednesday, was a certain unnamed drunken U.S. official sharing top secrets with Ahmed Chalabi when he should have been sharing in Recovery Corner? Plus, openly gay Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson will join us live in the studio. That's coming up. We've also got Howard Dean later, Chris Matthews. We're doing a sort of renegade study in productive mania. right now I'm joined by Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley here in the studio. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
In the unproductive mania.
Are you feeling better, Sue, at all?
A few cups of tea later, yes. Doing okay. Not quite so scratchy.
Got a couple of emails, and that kid who called, what am I, 50? That guy, I think his name was Richard, talking about Bush flip-flopping. Flip-flopper-in-chief, the triple flip-flop. Bush did a triple flip-flop. You want to hear about it? We talked about it last hour.
We're
in a new hour.
We're just through the flips and the flops.
Sure. Yeah, well, the one that Richard was talking about was the Osama bin Laden flip-flop, which happened quite a while ago. And I just had it right here in front of me, and now it went away.
He's like Osama's public enemy number one. We're going to spare no expense.
There it is, I want justice, and there's an old poster out west, I recall, that says wanted dead or alive, right? That was September 17th, 2001. Yeah. March 13th, 2002. I don't know where he is. I have no idea. I really don't care. Not that important. It's maybe he was on an airplane. Maybe he was on an airplane flying somewhere with the rest of his family that day, sponsored by the White House.
Yeah, but who was he talking? Was he talking about Osama or was he talking about al-Sadr? Because he doesn't have either one of them.
That was Osama.
I know.
He knows where al-Sadr is, though.
Does he? How come he hasn't killed or captured him?
Because they made a deal because he might be important. You don't want to go killing clerics.
Not to mention, if they did,
he's going to subcontract.
Probably create far more violence.
Here was the beautiful the triple flip flop. You want to go into the triple flip flop?
Come on with it.
We do.
April 13, 2004, Bush says U.S. won't leave Iraq until job is finished. I quote: "In terms of how long we'll be there, as long as necessary, not one day more." May 14, 2004. Bremer says, if the provisional government asks us to leave, we will leave. May 24th, 2004, given the recent increase in violence, this is Bush, we'll maintain our troop level at the current 138,000 as long as necessary. Yesterday.
UN resolution.
Yeah, you got it? No, yesterday, Bush says, the U.S.-sponsored UN resolution says the mandate shall expire upon the completion of the political process.
No longer open-ended.
No longer. We got a cap on it, but that's a triple flip-flop. Who's he to call Kerry a flip-flopper?
The big mistake was hanging on to that language, we will stay the course. The whole staying the course thing is just, an enormous error of language. It's trying to make everybody feel safe, feel that there's a commander-in-chief and head of the United States who knows what he's doing. And the only course he's staying is his own political course.
But exactly, because he didn't have a plan. He had no idea. He didn't have a plan for Iraq. They're trying to make it look like they've lucked into something. I think staying the course, that whole, I'm starting to believe that his whole rhetoric and appealing to people in that way is very much a sort of appeal to a Christian sensibility. I believe this whole idea that, hey, we're going to go through a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. We're going to go through a lot of pain. People are dying, but that happens.
This guy thinks he's out of this. Trust me. He believes that the worst is now behind him. He's got the resolution changed. He's got the new government. He's addressing the commencement at the Air Force Academy later today out in Colorado, and he's going to tell them that Iraq is the first step in a sweeping tide of democracy that's going to go all through the Middle East.
So you're saying it's not just a handover, it's a hand washing?
What he's saying is I have changed the course of Middle East politics and history.
But there's a problem with that, a huge problem with that, and that's that it's fine to reevaluate things. I mean, lots of things happened in Iraq over the last year that were many people thought were expected. George Bush apparently didn't, but then has been forced to backpedal on stuff. I don't have a problem with a government reevaluating, and for instance, bringing back the members of the Ba'ath Party if they got rid of them, bringing back the Iraqi police and training them when they got rid of them all.
What
they won't do, what I have a problem with is that they won't admit their mistakes, and yet they hang on to, in all evidence, that they are actually changing their mind about stuff and coming around to alternative views. They do what Mark Riley just said, which was he's acting as though this is that Iraq is the landing stage with this big U.S. spread of, you know, Western-style democracy through the Middle East. There is no evidence of that yet. It's fine to hand stuff over to the Iraqis. We won't know for a good number of months whether all this is going to be successful or not. But what you can't do is say, I've made lots of changes, and here they are, and that just proves everything else is on track. It's a nonsense.
Democracy or else.
Well, no, this is the precise blueprint that the neocons and his administration have been promoting from the beginning. We take out Iraq, we start this tide of democracy, and he's speaking to an obviously friendly audience. This is the Air Force Academy. This isn't MoveOn.org he's talking to today. He's speaking to a group of people who are extremely supportive of his policies and people who, in fact, will have a hand in implementing his policies.
It's interesting.
The U.S. military.
It's interesting, too, that the neocon agenda, you know, is, you know, part of it is this idea of democracy in Iraq, but another part of it is to, you know, over a period of time to detach almost completely from Saudi oil reserves and from Saudi oil industry. It's in there. It's in the neocon manifesto.
Well, it's in their agenda, but so too was Ahmed Shalabi, or Shalabi, shall we say.
the alleged
spying spineless weasel who apparently was told by a reportedly drunk U.S. official that the U.S. had cracked Iran, not Iraq, Iran's secret communications code.
And that's all that's enough.
Yeah.
Right there to be, you know, certainly for me to say that, you know, he is a spy. And certainly, you know, some other people, I think Pearl, one of the neocons, Richard, right? Yeah.
Richard Pearl, yeah.
You know, he's saying that Shalabi's innocent, that, you know, he's being set up because the CIA's got a beef with him. But clearly this guy is a devious and sort of seedy enough guy to where all these different factions are saying different things about him, which implies one thing to me, that in the character department he has little.
Well, remember, he was responsible for the de-Ba'athification. It was his officials from the Iraqi National Congress that were all through the Iraqi Governing Council. He was the one that was going to be handed the power when all of this was said and done. Now, he looks up. There is not a single cabinet member that has been named by Brahimi that has any connection to Shalabi whatsoever.
Now, all these, I think, you know, they're all details and they're all worth kind of mulling over and they all bring up valid points. But the thing I care about and I think will determine whether this new government is successful and whether the U.S. gets out cleanly and smoothly is, will the Iraqis have a say over the military operations? Because that's what people in Iraq care about.
They'll have a say, but will the say be heard?
Well, exactly. How strong a say will it be? That is the really crucial thing, is the forward-looking thing now, is how to make this new government look legitimate. Because the Iraqis themselves are very dubious.
There's only one way they can do that, and that is to give the Iraqi military an opt-out provision in any operation that takes place within the country. That's the only way they're going to have that level of credibility.
What does that mean exactly? You're saying that if there's a military operation that takes place that is an American agenda, or a coalition agenda, the Iraqis can say
no.
They basically have veto power over what happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And within their own country, you're saying a military operation that is supposed to, you know, cross borders. I mean,
no,
how does that work?
In other words, in their country, they don't want necessarily to be able to tell the Americans, no, you can't do that, although that would be nice. What they're saying is,
we can't do it with you.
Americans are not going to tell us what we are going to do in our own country. That's what they're saying.
And a lot of this will depend on the power or the effectiveness of the new member, you know, members of the new government to figure out or to stop the insurgency and violence that's been happening in Iraq. That is a crucial role.
True.
Right.
I'm not sure at this point whether the United States, because they didn't resolve this in the draft resolution. They did not say precisely whether the Iraqi military had the power to opt out, which means if it's not in the language, if it's not written down, then the American military wants to maintain the status quo.
And also, what condition is the Iraqi military in right now? I mean, it's not
even great.
Exactly. Still ahead, Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson will join us here in the studio. And up next, my dream diary. Get excited.
Uh-oh.
Right here on Air America Radio. 18 past the hour. I am Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. I'm here with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott. We have a guest in the studio I will introduce momentarily. Right now it is time to do my dream diary. As you know, my therapist tells me to write down my dreams and bring them into him on Thursdays. And I share them with you before I bring them to him. So this is last night. Let me see if I can make it out. I'm in ancient Egypt at the bottom of the Great Pyramid, about to drag the tip up the incline. It's my job to cap it and move the giant eye. I knew that. There are men with jackal heads and jackals with men's heads. Sacred cats with crowns on. One of them is my dead cat, Butch. I say, hey, Butch. She says, not here. I'm big here. There are crocodiles wearing human loafers and serpents that talk. In fact, they don't shut up. Next time an asp sits next to you anywhere, change seats. Me, I'm clearly a pyramid-building slave. It's 200 degrees. My tongue caught fire twice. I'm sweating rubies and giant beetles. Thousands of my people are all around me schwitzing and complaining. It's like Zabar's right before Passover. I'm tugging on this giant rope, and I say, so why are we building this pyramid? And this pushy asp on my shoulder says, so Ramses can have a comfortable journey to the afterlife. Do they have to whip us? What happened to please? Would you do this all by yourself? I say, if it were up to me, I'd be back in L.A. drinking some iced coffee and watching a little pay-per-view. Way in the distance, I see Ramses, only it's Dick Cheney in a skirt, wearing one of those King Tut headdresses, and he's bare-chested, not a pretty pharaoh. Harder, he screams. Whip them harder, harder. And just then, the sun god Ra descends from the heavens in a golden chariot and smites him. Nice going, Ra. Apparently, Ramses was a blasphemer. Loser. Then Isis pulls up in a speedboat, and we go cruising down the Nile, blasting the radio. I become a god and retire. I woke up and my bed was filled with Anubis, the god of embalming. What is that about? Do you have any idea? Right now, we are pleased to have in our studio Bishop Gene Robinson, the Bishop of New Hampshire and the first openly gay bishop to be consecrated in the Episcopal Church. Welcome to our show, sir.
Good morning. I don't think I'm going to be able to help you with your dream.
Can't you?
I'd like to, but it's way beyond me.
Nobody can help Mark with his dreams.
If you can't help me, who can?
No.
You have to bring it to my therapist. So there is the West Coast Anglicans are meeting Thursday and Friday on the issue of gay marriage. And, you know, what is the rift within the church exactly?
Well, ostensibly the rift is over the authority of Scripture, but I don't think that's actually the case. We all value the authority of Scripture. It's really a question of interpretation of Scripture. And I think it's also a matter of focus. These folks are saying that this issue of homosexuality trumps everything else that we have in common. I just don't think it's so.
So they're focusing on on making this one phrase in Scripture relevant above all else.
Yeah, there are only seven very brief passages that seem to pertain to same-sex behavior, and indeed, it doesn't mean exactly what it first looks like it means.
Right, and how do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, for instance, the whole concept of sexual orientation
is
only a little over 100 years old. So all of the scriptural references were written at a time when everyone was thought to be heterosexual. So anyone who acted in a same-sex manner was acting literally against their nature. It did not occur to us until about 100 years ago that there might be a certain minority of us born naturally to be attracted to people of the same sex. So we're taking a modern-day construct and reading it back into an ancient text.
Well, that's interesting that happens, is that you have to sort of de-relevize it.
Yeah. You have to figure out what it meant to the person who wrote it,
right,
and what it meant to the person who heard it back then, and then only ask the question, is this relevant now? Does it pertain to us now?
So it should live and breathe, almost like the Constitution.
Absolutely. I mean, the Jews have a great way of doing Scripture. They don't sort of sit back and admire it. They actually argue about, if you ever go to a Seder, you know, people are arguing about speaking of pharaohs, why the pharaoh brought the plagues and so on and so forth. They don't just sit back and worship it.
It's an active conversation of interpretation in order to keep it relevant and keep it alive.
Yep.
So has nobody come up with a new version of the Bible that's something that would allow for those that new way of thinking that people can be genetically attracted to members of the same sex?
Well, I think you can't change what the text is. What you can do is change the way the text is read and what kind of claim it has on us today, knowing what we know. It was also written at a time, and particularly in the Old Testament, where men were thought to contain everything necessary for life. Women simply provided a place for this new life to incubate. There was no notion that women had any role in the creation of a child.
They believe that in this administration now.
There probably are a few who do. Yeah.
Bishop Robinson, I'm curious because it pains me to some extent that a lot of the opposition to gays in the Episcopal priesthood comes from Africa and many of the congregations in Africa, along with some conservative congregations here in the States. Is their opposition both rooted in other words, are they both the same, or are there slight differences in terms of what the African congregations are saying versus perhaps what some of the more conservative U.S. congregations are saying?
Right. I think one of the things that gets very mixed up in the reaction of people in Asia and Africa is our colonialism is coming back to haunt us. And I think the Southern Hemisphere is pretty angry at the Northern Hemisphere anyway. The way we're operating in the world in such an incredibly unilateral manner and kind of swaggering around the world, having our way with it, does not play well in that part of the world. And I think that dynamic gets mixed up in this. You also have to understand that most of Africa, for instance, was evangelized by the very, very evangelical part of the Church of England. And so they've always been a very much more biblically literal kind of a church. Nobody's telling them they have to be different in their context. The difficulty is they don't seem to want to let us be different in our context.
Is that, does that mean that there's a real threat that some elements of the Episcopal Church will withdraw and form their own separate group?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. When I was nominated, they said that they would leave if I was elected. Then they said they would leave if I was consented to. Then they said they would leave if I was consecrated. And now they say they're staying.
Now they say they'll leave if you leave.
Exactly.
But this brings me to the point that, you know, all churches seem to have to evolve. Some are clearly kind of faster and more reactive to what members of their congregations feel happening socially, morally, great shifts in society. Isn't it going to be sort of inevitable at some point that you know, churches are going to have to bless same-sex unions? Isn't it? Are we going to move in that direction inexorably?
Well, I certainly think so. I think the prior step is the civil right of marriage, which is really separate from what any denomination will do in response to that. But I think this is God working. It's not just people changing their minds. I think God is at work in this. And bringing us to this new place. You know, we believe in a living God, not one who's locked up in Scripture 2,000 years ago, but through the Holy Spirit is actually moving in the world today. And I think we're being led into this new truth.
What about don't you think that there will also evolve some sort of schism between evangelical people and non-evangelical people, and that you're going to almost have a war within the church on some level?
Well, I really hope not, because, right. I mean, one of the great things about the Episcopal Church is that we have always been this wonderful umbrella under which lots of people can disagree. Lordy, we disagree about abortion and genetic cell research, the war in Iraq, who should be president, and yet we all come to the altar rail and receive communion together and then go back to the pews and fight about those things.
Well, what do you think about them politicizing these people with the rainbow sashes who were only showing their support for gay unions and gay people in general being denied communion?
Well, I think absolutely no one should be denied communion. That is setting yourself up to be God. And, you know, God should be the judge in this, not priests standing behind the altar, nor bishops, nor archbishops. There ought to be no one denied communion for any reason.
There were people, obviously your opponents were very visible, very vocal. Do you think that your supporters, the people in the church that believed that you should be consecrated, were they vocal enough during the process?
Oh, I think so. I felt enormously supported. And let's face it, the support showed itself in an overwhelming election in New Hampshire and a two-thirds majority of the bishops, two-thirds of a majority of the clergy, and two-thirds majority of the laity of our National General Convention. It's the only body that can speak for the whole Episcopal Church. I couldn't have asked for more support than that.
Bishop Gene Robinson, as the Bishop of New Hampshire and the first openly gay bishop to be consecrated in the Episcopal Church, do you have a sense from meeting at your multi-faith gatherings of, you know, what, you know, how Americans are split or how they've changed on looking at kind of George Bush's leading America into the Gulf War based on reasons of faith?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, I think the biggest problem here is that we have let the religious right speak for all Christians, and mainline Christians are not in the same place that the religious right is. I also think that we are so generally bought into the culture with our tax-exempt status and so on, it's very hard to bite the hand that feeds you. And I'm not sure that we'll ever reclaim our prophetic role until we're not so in bed with the government.
I'd like to talk some more about that when we come back from the break. I'd also like you to address when we come back from the break, you know, how you would address the convention of West Coast you know, Anglicans. You know, that's gonna when is that? It's Thursday and Friday, and
I believe that's right.
And is it primarily clergy from all over? Or?
Do you know what? I don't pay that much attention to them. This is a very small group of unhappy people, and I'm not very up on it. But I'll tell you what I think when we come back.
Terrific.
All right, straight ahead more with Bishop Eugene Robinson. You on the phones, plus Recovery Corner, and later, Hardball's Chris Matthews and former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Howard Dean. This is Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 33 past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, here with Mark Ryland, Sue Ellicott. Our guest in the studio is Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson. We were talking of many things, and what we were going to talk about now is how you want to, how would you address this, as you called this sort of, what was your wording, this frightened group of mean little people? Am I paraphrasing?
I believe those are your words. Yes, you are paraphrasing.
The West Coast
Not
Anglicans.
Not terribly accurately, I might say.
The West Coast.
Well, no, I want to take these people very seriously.
Yes.
They are representing a group of people in our church who are only believing what they've been taught to believe,
right?
Which is that in the eyes of God, homosexual people are abominations. So, these people are experiencing some real pain. The leadership of this group, however, is a bit suspect in my book. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they aren't using people who are in a great pain over this issue for some other ends. I mean, look at the name of what they're calling this gathering. First of all, they're calling it an historic gathering. Well, they've only had one of these before. What makes this one historic?
Right.
It's a young country.
That's right. But just calling it historic doesn't make it historic.
It kind of charges it for the sort of setting it up as being part of this culture war.
That's right.
It's setting up be politicized.
That's right. And then they say it's a gathering of Anglicans committed to the Great Commission. Well, I'm committed to the Great Commission. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to let them hijack that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been sent into the world to preach the gospel just the way they have.
So that's what the Great Commission is?
Yeah. It's a sort of Jesus' last words before he ascended into heaven was to go into all nations and make disciples and baptize people in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I'm about. You know, they use this word orthodox like they own it. I'm orthodox.
Hmm.
Being orthodox means believing in the ancient creeds. It means believing in our baptismal promises and our catechism and so on. There's nothing about sexuality in that.
So the orthodoxy, or what they're calling the orthodoxy, these people who are they're not fanatics, but they're just towing the party line, and they're playing to these people's fear.
Yeah. So I have a congregation in New Hampshire
yes.
right now that I went over to meet with. They have sort of driven off the 20 or 30 people who favored my consecration, and there are about 20 or 30 of them left. And they want an Orthodox bishop to come in to take care of them instead of me. So I go over and I ask them what they want. They say Orthodox. And so I say, well, tell me what Orthodox is. So they describe what they mean. And I say, well, that's great. I agree with you. You're describing me.
Right.
Well, ultimately what we got to is they want someone who will agree with them on the issue of homosexuality. It has nothing to do with orthodoxy.
Right.
Bishop Robinson, isn't it maddening at a point to be judged not by your works as a priest, not by the things that you've done, not by the content of your character, but so almost solely by your sexuality? I mean, it almost bothers me to say that, you know, openly gay Bishop Gene Robinson.
Right. Well, you know what that means. You're an African-American. You know what it's like to not be judged for who you are and what you contribute to the world by some other standard and lumped in with a whole bunch of people. No, it doesn't feel great, but it does seem to be the way of the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there could maybe be some advantages, though, is that, you know, even though it sort of sounds maybe awkward, is that you kind of be out there and kind of pushing the argument that it really does make no difference. I mean, it does take an amount of certain amount of bravery to give yourself that kind of tagline. But ultimately, I would imagine that over your career, in the church that you have seen that cause great changes.
Well, that's true. But, you know, the biggest note of hope here is that in the Diocese of New Hampshire, I'm not the gay bishop. I'm just the bishop.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I think we're headed with this, so that it will just be one of many things that people know about you. And in New Hampshire, you know, our churches are growing like crazy. Everywhere I go, we've got standing room only. We've got people coming to find out about this Episcopal Church. We've got tons of Roman Catholics converting to the Episcopal Church because this is the kind of community they want to raise their kids in.
Running from the Catholic Church.
Yeah, some of them.
Yeah, and how do you address the national issue of you have a president in office who wants to amend the Constitution. You have a president in office who's allowing evangelical, you know, sort of, you know, insanity dictate his policy. What's your reaction to that as a man of
Well, like I said before, I think we have allowed the conservative right to speak for all of Christianity, and I think certainly our president is in that camp, and I think efforts like MoveOn.org and those kinds of things are beginning to say, you know what, they don't speak for all Christians in this country, and they don't speak for all thoughtful people in this country, and I think we need to add our voices to that.
Can you speak to the faith-based initiatives that he's trying to put, that he's funneling money out of government programs that have been helping people into what's assumed to be sort of evangelical voting bloc churches?
So I think the more we can preserve this, the complete separation of church and state, the better off we're going to be. I alluded to before sort of being in bed with the government, and I think that's a step in the wrong direction rather than in the right direction.
Right.
Bishop, and I've spoken to a couple of people about this, not clergy people, but people who have knowledge about the workings of the Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
Cynics, I suppose, and they say that one of the reasons why some of the more conservative Episcopal clerics will not move to separate from the larger church is financial, and that, in fact, their pensions would be severely disrupted because their pensions wouldn't follow them to a new church. Is there any truth to that?
Well, the couple things there. One is you don't lose your pension, but if you leave mid-career, then you don't have the number of years of service, of course, to figure out what that formula is. So that is a factor, although it's not a factor for those already retired. They don't lose their pensions. What I do think is an issue here is you can't leave and take your property with you.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone is free to leave. But you can't leave and take your church building, you can't take your endowment, you can't take the assets of the church because that's been left to the Episcopal Church.
Hmm. So in other words, they really would have to start from scratch.
That's exactly right.
And that's why they won't go.
That's what a lot of people are saying.
Can I ask you some personal questions?
Sure.
How'd you meet your boyfriend?
Partner,
thank you.
Sorry.
Believe it or not, I walked onto a beach in St. Croix and met him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It was quite delightful.
And what was the process of I guess, coming out to your congregation?
Well, at the time, I wasn't in a congregation, but I was working for I had just begun my work as the assistant to the Bishop of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was out to him before I took that job. I had just come out, had just separated from my wife, and she had gotten remarried. And about 2 months later, I met Mark.
Okay. Oh, so you, yeah, okay. So that sounds nice.
It was nice. And that was 17 years ago. We've been together ever since. He helped me raise my two daughters. They were 5 and 9 when he came, and they consider themselves to have three dads and a mom.
Lucky. That's how everyone gets along. That's beautiful.
You bet.
So we're going to come back with Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson. We want to hear your questions for him. So give us a call at 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. You can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. And we'll have the Presidential Daily Briefing as well. So come back. Past the hour, we're taking your calls for Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson at 866-303-AAR0. Give us a call, but right now it's time for the Presidential Daily Briefing, the highly classified document that gets to the President's desk every day from the intelligence community. Today's PDB, silence, colon, again. Mr. President, it has come to our attention that Secretary of State Colin Powell has been pressuring the CIA for several months to account for the faulty intelligence that led him to tell the United Nations last year that Iraq definitely possessed illicit weapons. When this administration lies to Powell, it expects Powell to pass on that lie, and with at least a modicum of conviction. not go around whining afterwards that he was fed bad information like some jilted mistress. Someone should point out to the Secretary of State that information is only bad if people don't believe it. And people were believing the Iraq WMD story before Powell started shooting his mouth off. Perhaps the Secretary doesn't realize that he's only here to play for the cameras. He doesn't get script approval. The ideal team player does what he's told and stays on message regardless of how ridiculous it makes him look. Just like you, Mr. President, and don't think Mr. Cheney doesn't appreciate it. We suggest that Powell be kept out of all possible loops until November, up to and including staff baby showers and TGIF get-togethers. Respectfully, Office of Homeland Security. Mm. Margaret in Eastchester, New York. Margaret, how are you? You have a question for the bishop.
Good morning, Bishop. Thank you for being there. Is there a reason, having been brought up Catholic and knowing that priests were never allowed to marry, I don't understand why other people have not thought or discussed that Jesus and his apostles were, it would seem, gay people?
Thank you for your call, Margaret.
Well, as far as we know, there's no evidence to indicate that that Jesus was married. It's a big jump from that to believe that they were gay. We have absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. What we do know is that he believed in community and had both men and women around him, and there was this one disciple called the one whom Jesus loved. There are about four references to that, St. John. And but I would not contend in any way that this indicates that Jesus or any particular disciples were gay.
Here's an email. I am really on board with you guys, but I am sorry that I cannot agree with Gene Robinson about homosexuality being a blessing or allowed by God. This is something that God has destroyed a town about. Ask Lot and his wife and see what he has to say about it. I am not a homophobe, but the anything goes policy that you promote has to have boundaries sooner or later.
Well, I'm not proposing an anything-goes policy, and let's take a look at the Sodom and Gomorrah story. It's not exactly something that we would want to emulate. Yeah, the town was destroyed. If that is about anything, it's about homosexual rape. These men are wanting the guests to come out so that they can be raped, not anything that we would espouse today. And not only that, but Lot offers his daughter instead. Would we want our virgin daughters offered in exchange for saving someone from homosexual rape? This is not a story that we want to tell our children and draw conclusions that aren't there.
So this is just like about depravity, not about sexuality.
It is about depravity. And in fact, it's referenced a couple of other times in Scripture, once by Jesus, and who says that the real sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was that they were not kind to the poor. They were greedy. They were not about justice, and so on and so forth. There's nothing about sexuality there. And let's remember, Jesus said absolutely nothing about this topic.
Mm-hmm. Catherine in Westchester. Catherine.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I want to say that I am completely on board with Gene's approach to Scripture, and that we are part of a living God that always speaks to us, that Scripture is alive. However, right after convention, people were very fragile, people of deep conviction, and they needed to process what had just happened. They still need to process it. I wondered why he chose this time to get married to Mark when everyone is so fragile, and why he didn't wait until the Ames Commission report came out.
Thank you, Catherine.
Well, first of all, Catherine, I've not married my partner, Mark. He and I had a blessing of our home 15 years ago. We'll celebrate the 15th anniversary of that on July 2nd. I have not married my partner, nor do I have any plans to, until it becomes legal in New Hampshire, which could be sometime after the next ice age.
That brings up an interesting point, is that do you find that in your position as an openly gay member of the Episcopal Church, that you are a kind of a victim of many myths and many preconceptions, and that you spend a lot of time having to dispel them?
Well, I've actually tried to learn to be at peace with the fact that there's a lot of misinformation out there. The one that was the most disturbing, and it's still out there, is that I abandoned my wife and children when I left them, when in fact this was a very mutual decision. I never abandoned my children. They have been with us every weekend of their lives. And my wife was one of my presenters at my consecration. We have a great relationship. So I've just learned to, if I spent all my time chasing these rumors, I wouldn't have time to be the Bishop of New Hampshire, which is what I really feel called to do and be. But yes, it's on a bad day, it's very discouraging to have all that kind of misinformation out there.
Well, you just inspired me not to take my emails so seriously. That's for sure. Adam in New Jersey, how are you?
Hey, Adam.
Adam? Maybe not. Oh, how about Tom in Long Island? Tom?
Actually, the bishop just answered my point, which was I'm a free thinker. Uh-huh. And Jesus said nothing against homosexuality. It's always the Old Testament. And you don't follow the Old Testament in the sense that you're not kosher, right?
That's right.
Bishop?
That's right.
You know, so I love how people just pick and choose, you know, what they want to believe in if it suits their own personal beliefs and prejudices, as opposed to looking to what Jesus said. Jesus was all about love and understanding and acceptance. I mean, he hung out with prostitutes and tax collectors, and you can't get lower than that.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Tom is absolutely right about that. And indeed, these two famous passages in Leviticus are preceded and followed by passages which tell us not to wear two kinds of cloth at the same time, not to plant two different kinds of seed in the same field, all the kosher laws and so on, none of which the people who are ranting and raving about homosexuality would follow themselves.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be
Gene Robinson.
Here.
It was certainly great talking to you. I hope you come back sometime.
Been my pleasure.
Okay, have a great day. And we'll be back, so we hope you come back. You're on Air America Radio. Good morning. That was fun. Bishop Gene Robinson.
Yeah.
He's a very cool guy.
Yeah, I'm Mark Maron, and it's Sue Elcott and Mark Riley here on Morning Sedition. He looked right through me. He knew. He knew that I wasn't a believer.
He knew he could hear.
He said directly to Mark, he was walking, I said, keep going to church. He said, very nice to meet you. And he said, fine.
See you.
No. Yeah, no. No.
I don't think he's all about saving, but he'd be even very open-minded to you. You could go to long-term his church.
I was going to bring it up. I was going to bring it up, but then you know the possibility, if I'm too vulnerable, I might be saved on the air, and that it would be make for good radio, but I don't know how comfortable I'd be after that. But I would like to say I am Mark, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
In Recovery Corner, I reach out to fellow 12-steppers who are struggling to stay clean and sober. Today, as I usually do, I'm reaching out to George W., who is my sponsee, who I've chosen to be my sponsee. George, I read that Ahmed Chalabi tipped off the Iranians that the Americans had broken their secret intelligence code. Reportedly, Chalabi got this information from a drunken U.S. official. Now, before you get all defensive, that could be almost anybody, but I didn't hear from you this weekend, and you implied that you would check in with me at some point, and you do know lots of information of a sensitive nature. Plus, you do seem way too chummy with this Chalabi character, this convicted embezzler, this smooth-talking charlatan who tells you what you want to hear, like Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, like they'll welcome us as liberators. I mean, what a crock. He's exactly the kind of guy people like us have to avoid. Remember, buddy, people, places, and things, you know? I hope you're not a drunken U.S. official because, you know, loose lips sink ships. But, you know, get to a meeting. Remember, bend your knee before you bend your elbow one day at a time. First things first. Remember, if you got one foot in yesterday, the other foot in tomorrow, you're peeing on today. Don't drink. And that's it for today. Do the next right thing. How about that? Keep the plug in the jug. That's you know what? This is interesting, but it happens here on Morning Sedition occasionally. We seem to have a caller on the phone, a drunken White House official. Hello?
Hi, Mark?
Yeah, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, I resent the drunken thing. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
No, is this?
I know what you're talking about.
Now, are you the guy? Are you
Mark?
Wait, who are you? Why don't you give us your identity?
I can't do that. I have security clearance.
But,
very stressful work in the government. Very stressful work.
What's your relationship with this Chalabi guy?
Oh, Chalabi's my party guy. He's great.
So,
I love you, man.
Are you saying that he did? Did he get you drunk? What'd you tell him, man?
I didn't tell him.
Just,
I told him stuff.
All right.
I told him a lot.
Why don't you just tell us who you are, man? Just tell us who.
Mark, I have security clearance. Can't talk. Can't talk about bombing Syria. Can't talk about. Can't talk about keeping Osama.
You know about security clearance. Wait, who is this?
Can't talk about it.
Who is this?
Mark! Can't talk about
Who
it.
Who is this?
More Jaeger, dude. More Jaeger.
All right, we're going to get it out of you eventually. We're
no,
going to get it.
Not.
Yeah, we are.
Not about Syria in August. No. Not about that.
I'm writing this down.
Me.
We're tapping the phone. Come on. Come on. Oh, man.
Can't make me talk.
Hey, dude, sober up and call us back and tell us who you are.
No. You call me back and tell me who you are.
All right. All right.
Pretty clear.
All right. All right. Prankster. That sounded like you knew what he was talking about, though.
Well, I don't know. He sounds like...
Didn't sound like Bush, though.
No, didn't sound like Bush. But sounded like somebody that might hang out with Shalabi.
Yeah.
Shalabi.
He's a party guy.
You say tomato, I say... I don't know what the real pronunciation of this guy's name is. It seems like everybody in Iraq has two different pronunciations and about five different spellings.
We got Howard Dean coming up, man.
Yes, we do.
Oh, we know how to spell him. That's
we know
okay.
how to spell
Chris Matthews.
We can spell
That's
him,
right.
too.
Chris, we're not done yet.
I'm going to get a word in, I wonder.
And the presidential palm pilot.
Yeah, well,
and the countdown to democracy when we continue here on Air America Radio.
Hey, I'm Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, Wednesday, we're getting Howard Dean on the phone. He's talking about how we're going to take back America, plus Harbaugh's Chris Matthews. Wow, that's a manic 8 o'clock hour between those guys and me. Some of you are going to be drained out there. You're certainly going to be awake. We've got the liberal agenda coming up. We've got Mark Riley right here. We've got Sue Ellicott right over here.
Hey.
Man, I'm going to have to pull back. Some guy got all wired out on me yesterday when I went off on the Day After Tomorrow movie. There was an email that's sort of like, why is he getting all mad about a movie? It's just entertainment, for God's sakes. Tell him to settle down. He's going crazy. It's
oh, you think he was wrong.
Of course he was wrong.
Going?
Of course
exactly.
he was wrong. I'm still like, you know, there was a moment there with Bishop Gene Robinson, who was just in the studio, where, like, there's always that moment where, like, see, I don't believe in God. You know, I'm not critical necessarily of religion. I understand the importance of belief for people. You know what I mean?
But not for you.
But sometimes, dude, sometimes, you know, if you're having a weird moment, you know what I mean? If you're having a vulnerable moment, And you need to, you know, and somebody senses that. Like, there are little, like, groups of teenagers that are dispatched on New York, evangelical teenagers, whose job is to go through the subways. Have they ever come up to you in the subway to check? Have you heard about
Jesus? They know better.
They know better?
Yes.
But they're basically there to save souls, you know. And if you're having a bad day, you know, like, one day I was feeling a little vulnerable, a little needy, kind of down on my luck. And I'm walking through the subway, and some little, you know, kid comes up to me, a teenager, he goes, have you accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior? Have you taken Jesus Christ into your heart?
And yeah. How did you
what
answer
did you
him?
Say? Exactly.
I said,
have you listened to the figs?
No, I said, would that help? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, what do I do tomorrow if I want him out? I mean, how long does it stay in my heart once it's in my heart to Jesus?
And he thought, uh-oh, I've been warned about people like this. And
yeah,
he said, sorry.
Nice
and
talking to you.
Backed off.
I've invited Jehovah's Witnesses into my house before. That's always it.
And locked the door.
Well, one time they came, like these two women came, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and they came, and, you know, I was just getting up. I was in my bathrobe, and I was at my parents' house. And I'm like, yeah, come on in. You guys, you know, you want some coffee or something? And I'm like, tell me about what you got. What do you got? And I'm all being all devilly, and I smell like liquor and stuff. And they actually said, you know, we're going to come back later with somebody else. And they came back the next day with a man. So there's two women there. Like, they felt threatened by my strange, perverse masculinity at that moment.
Yeah, I might come with a couple people tomorrow. It's a good idea.
Then another one came in L.A., these two Jehovah's Witnesses. No, they were Mormons. The Mormons, you know, they're the ones that dress like the Blues Brothers. The Mormons came. And there were two women, and they wanted to give me the Book of Mormon. And I said, I'll only take the Book of Mormon if you take my book, Jerusalem Syndrome, and read it. I will read the Book of Mormon. And
then
they made their excuses and left, too.
No, they did not.
Oh, okay.
They took the book, and I took their book, and they never came back again. So I was perfectly willing to have a perfectly decent discussion about me with them, though I didn't read there. So maybe they're tapped in somehow, and they're waiting for me to read the Book of Mormon.
Because
they got the big connections.
I think you would have a decently very good, actually pretty good time if you went off to one of the services led by Bishop Gene Robinson. I think you'd find it interesting and maybe even fun.
Yeah.
I am open to being, moved. You know what I mean? I certainly appreciate a good rap, a good riff.
We should take him along
one
weekend, Riley, don't you think?
Yeah, take them to. Yeah.
Oh
them
no, they're gang doing me.
No, we're not.
Yes, they are. They're tag teaming me. They're doing the Christian tag team on me.
No,
here
no,
in the
no.
Studio.
Wait,
know what's going on. You guys start. This is all. This is all part of the whole big thing. Now the producer's in on it. They're all pushing me.
No,
that's what this is all about, isn't it?
It'd be like mom and dad sitting either side of you.
What's that?
No.
It'd be like mom and dad sitting either side of
you. The church I go
to
would not try in any way, shape, or form to proselytize, to get you to convert, none of that.
They would
just welcome you into the
service
house.
And go, who brought the Jew into the house of Jesus?
No.
No, you would just be kind of welcomed, tolerated.
Wait, what are you talking about, Sue? What church do you go to?
I don't go to church anymore.
Oh, so you're just playing along with this?
No, but I used to go to a very open-minded church where there's a huge amount
of singing. So open-minded you don't have to go anymore?
That's
it. Is that it's so open-minded that you don't have to go that you could do it from home? You just email occasionally?
ISDN.
I wasn't saying that.
Telecommuting?
It's very far. But it was a church that was incredibly inclusive and at its time, you know, alienated a huge number of the more, I would say, traditional, kind of uptight, kind of older members of the, you know, quite strict Anglican church. And we had a new minister who came, who played the guitar, who invited this pop star, Cliff Richard.
Who was very famous
in Britain. Americans always laugh at. And actually, when I was 10, that was my first LP I ever bought. So it was a big deal when he came, and I sang in the church choir and rang the bells, and it was a huge part of my life. But anybody could go along. They were incredibly welcoming. And my parents were absolutely horrified.
Yeah.
Because they said that my going to church on Sunday messed up the family plans to go to the beach.
Uh-huh.
They were furious.
Oh. So you had very secular parents.
Completely. They were horrified that this child rebelled and started going to church.
My little brother came home once. My little brother, Craig, he comes home when we were little kids. He was going to a different school than me. He came home singing, Jesus loves me, yes he does. Like that song, I don't know the song. And my parents are like, what are you singing? Where'd you learn that? And he's like, at school. And they're like, you're Jewish. You know, Jesus, no. And, you know, so they went to the school and but it's odd. My brother ended up going to St. Pius High School in Albuquerque, New Mexico, because it was a
really?
Good school. Yeah.
Now, the Catholics didn't have a problem with his being Jewish going there?
Well, he had to wear the Christ Killer shirt whenever he went to school. But aside from that, they labeled him, you know. But aside from that, he got a very good education. He wasn't involved with any sports or
but he didn't have to go to catechism or any of that stuff? Because, you know.
It wasn't that religious, this one.
Schools can be very kind of open-minded up to a point. Remember last week we had on Tony Hendra?
Yeah.
Formerly of National Lampoon, has written that. I'm halfway through his book, Father Joe, about growing up with this contemplative Benedictine monk. It's a great influence in his life. And he apparently was a stunningly bright boy, Tony Hendra, at his school. He was at a Christian school, not Catholic school, and was one of the best students. When it came to becoming head boy, he was the first choice of everybody. But the headmaster pulled him in and said, absolutely not, because you're one of those papists.
Wow.
So they were fine that he got the scholarship to Cambridge and everything else that looked really stellar and fantastic for the school, but they drew the line at giving him any kind of public role because they said the parents would freak out and he wouldn't
He was Catholic.
Because he was Catholic. He was discriminated against because he was Catholic.
What is it with the British and Catholics anyway? I saw Brideshead Revisited
Henry
back in
the
day. They could take
That's
hundreds of
was.
Years to answer that question. We got a good one for the secularists, right? It's not the Supreme Court, but the court in San Francisco.
No, a federal judge in that Sodom on the Pacific, San Francisco,
yes,
has ruled that the Partial Birth Abortion Act, you know, the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act,
right,
that was signed into law, I believe, last November by President Bush, is unconstitutional and it infringes on a woman's right to choose.
Right, sweet. Which we all knew, which we felt, and that's great. Okay, especially in an election year that you have somebody that high up in the judiciary kind of staking out that turf. So now what happens?
Well, Judge Phyllis Hamilton's ruling will be appealed by the Bush administration. But what I find fascinating, this lawsuit was brought by Planned Parenthood, and there are actually two other ones that are being heard in New York and in Nebraska. But what's fascinating to me about this is that the response to it came not from the president, not from the White House, but from the Bush reelection campaign.
Hmm.
They actually, we should say the Justice Department too, but the Bush reelection campaign said today's tragic ruling upholding partial birth abortion shows why America needs judges who will interpret the law and not legislate from the bench. John Kerry's judicial nominees would similarly frustrate the people's will and allow this grotesque procedure.
Would do things like be just and deliberate things fairly. Those horrible liberal judges.
Well, what they're saying there is that the first order of business in a second Bush administration will be to go to San Francisco and clean house
to kill the judges.
Yeah, literally,
we're going to string up the judges.
This is a big setback because the Bush administration has hoped to kind of chip back any kind of abortion rights and ultimately. Try to get at Roe v. Wade. So this is a significant block.
If it doesn't become a rallying point. I mean, it's a setback as long as they don't spin it in their direction. I'm probably giving them ideas, but I doubt it. I'm sure they already had that idea.
This is going to go straight to the Supreme Court.
That's good. Hopefully it's good. You don't know whether you can trust them.
You never
either.
Know.
Hey, we're going to be back. We got Chris Matthews with us from Hardball. We got Howard Dean later in the hour. We've got the President's Palm Pilot and much more on Air America Radio. Nineteen past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. I'm here with Mark Reilly and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. My buddy just earlier got me the presidential Palm Pilot. He hacked in today when he was cleaning up the Oval Office. My dude in the White House. Here's the president's schedule for today. June 2nd, 8 a.m., wake up. 28 days to Iraq handover, a.k.a. Operation Not My Problem. 9 a.m., respond to Kerry's plan to fight nuclear terrorism without having to say the word nuclear. Sorry, I mean nuclear. Nuclear. Damn. Nuclear. 9:30 a.m. Fly to Colorado. Remember, high altitude makes you lightheaded. Cool. 11:05 a.m. Give commencement address at Air Force Academy. Very important. Do not wear flight suit or helmet.
Mm-hmm.
12:30 p.m. Chat with Air Force Academy graduates. Subjects to avoid: Texas Air National Guard Service, Iraq, Texas Air National Guard Service, the economy, Texas Air National Guard Service. 2 p.m., prep for weekend trip to Italy. Try to remember when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie. That's what is that called? There's a word for that. Prep for meeting with Pope. Learn some useful phrases in Popish. 9:10 p.m., call new president of Iraq after 9 o'clock. Don't waste 8-10 minutes. 9:50 p.m., put on flight suit and helmet. Gaze wistfully into the mirror. Give self thumbs up. 10 p.m., lights out. 10:01 p.m., lights on. Take off flight helmets. 10:02 p.m., lights out.
I like that image of him with a crick in his neck with the helmet on.
Right. Well, then you savor that image. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball. He will be doing special coverage for the network on the 60th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mark.
How are you? You all right?
I am great.
Good. I'm going to try. I'm already talking like you.
Speed it up a little.
Yeah, I'm preempting you. I'm preempting the Matthews speak. This weekend, President Bush saluted World War II veterans at the opening of the new memorial. Later, he'll be addressing the 60th anniversary of the events. Do you think Bush will try to link his wartime presidency with that of FDR during World War II? There you go. There's the laugh.
What a setup. What do you think he's doing? Of course he's doing that.
So he's gonna,
of course, the trouble is you need allies to carry it off, don't you? How about allies?
Yeah, he's going to need that first.
I don't think we got a whole lot of them to put together. One thing I was reading in Time this week about this German, he was an officer defending the beaches at Normandy, and he said, I saw the allies overhead. They were attacking. I mean, even they called us the allies.
Right.
And I thought, nobody calls us the allies. Excuse me, the coalition forces. I mean, I really do think that the allies is a great word, and if John Kerry, the candidate, were smart, he'd say alliances, 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 just like Bush says terrorism, 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 over and over again, because it's a masculine, strong-sounding term instead of international cooperation.
Right.
Alliances sounds tough and smart.
But Bush doesn't really, it's all big myth. He barely has a coalition. How is he going to sell this? How is he going to play?
Well, because he's going to give a good speech. Because they're going to. Oh yeah, he'll give a good speech. Don't expect it not to be a good one. It'll be ready.
He's feeling. He's feeling all juiced up because he's almost washed his hands of Iraq, right?
Well, not. He did. Maybe he can't. I mean, the Iraq is the pivot of this election. It's
right.
going to turn on. There's no way history will not be written as to this election being a vote on Iraq.
Yes.
Whether if it's a blunder, if you think it's a blunder, you're going to vote for Kerry. If you think it's a swell, you're going to vote for Bush. If you think it's badly handled, you might well vote for Kerry.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I'm an election. What do you call it?
A commentator.
A viewer, observer. My skepticism about the war has been manifest from day one.
Okay, all right.
And everybody who watches the show knows my skepticism. I do not believe that anyone with any experience on this planet could not have predicted resistance to an armed occupation of another country. I don't care where it is in the world, and especially in the case of the Middle East, where those countries have all been colonized in the past and have thrown off colonization and occupation. And anyone who didn't expect nationalism must not understand or sense nationalism themselves. I don't know how you can be born in this world and not feel nationalism and get it.
Right.
This is what drives people to kill, to die, to fight, to be a country. It's a sense of... Call it tribalism, call it what you want, call it patriotism.
Chris,
they all mean the same thing. It means sticking out for your own crowd against the invader.
Are you on a treadmill, Chris?
No.
Okay, you just sounded a little winded. Yeah, Sue.
Chris Matthews.
I guess I'm thrilled to be on. This is my first time on Air American.
I hear
so much about it.
It's great to have you, man.
Yeah.
Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball. What do you think of Kerry's Let America Be America Again slogan? And is that going to get people fired up?
I have no idea what it means.
You don't know
you
what
don't
it means?
You don't know what it means?
No, what does it mean?
It's something catchy. You know, it's like a jingle. What's it supposed
Try
to mean,
again.
Chris? America used to be something that it isn't now. For all those people who think America isn't what it used to be, then it means everything.
I think a country that had a flag when we knocked off the British, which I have to say right now, when we knocked off the British, we had a flag which was called the Gadsden flag, which was a snake, a rattlesnake, which is indigenous to North America, and it said, "Don't tread on me."
Right.
And that was our basic view of the world, which is don't bother the United States. I do feel that the President of the United States was able to exploit that sentiment and convince the public that Iraq attacked us on 9/11.
Right.
And I do believe he's been effective in doing that to the point where most of the people who support this war, I believe, instinctively believe that Iraqis attacked us 9/11. Now, that is based, I would argue, on ignorance. Fostered by a president who has done nothing to disabuse people of that because it's been useful to him in selling the war.
Isn't it
the country western music? Listen to the music that sells the war.
Yeah,
Remember how you felt? Well, what's that about? It's about ignorance and promulgating ignorance.
Let me ask you a question about that. With so much information out there and so much of the correct and true information out there, how are they so able to spin it so efficiently? Are people that stupid or they just don't want to know the truth? What do you think?
Have you heard Kerry once say Iraq didn't attack us 9/11? Have you heard Kerry out there once go out and formally take on the president's argument and logic and his statements of fact? Have you ever heard Kerry take them on frontally and say the arguments he made for this war are untrue?
We believe that, you know, it's something in our heart is telling us that Kerry is waiting and that he's going to come out like a warrior in the final rounds and just really take this guy out. You don't see that? What do you think?
Well, that may be tactical. I mean, strategic. I mean, it might be very wise on his part to wait until people have really turned against the war, say, and are receptive to a broadside, say, at the convention or later even, and maybe even on Labor Day, to say, you know, damn it, I'm tired of holding back. The evidence is in. This war wasn't justified by the facts. WMD, connection to Al-Qaeda, liberation, the lack of resistance, the oil's going to pay for it. And I'm not going to say it now, but the trouble I guess he faces in saying that is that he voted for the war resolution.
Right. So, but you're the mainstream media. You're a journalist, and you're putting this stuff out. You're being critical of this president. Do you think
that? I say it, but I also have to be nonpartisan. I have to say the facts. But I can't come out and say vote for Kerry because I don't want to say that because I don't believe that's in any way my role. And my role to say that people should deduce from that
But being critical,
that Kerry would be a better president, and that's his case he has to make.
Right, but being critical isn't being partisan. That's part of the responsibility of the journalists.
Well, I think that's right. I think being skeptical is the job of media. Right.
Chris, how interested do you think that people, that the American public is really in issues in this Kerry-Bush race?
I think it's one time that the war, one issue, is the dominant pivot of the campaign. And I think that's, you could say in 1952 when Eisenhower came in, it was the stalemate in Korea. You could say in 68 it was the concern that the Vietnam War had become unwinnable. You could argue that as recently as 1980, the hostage crisis in Iran was such a major emblematic embarrassment for President Carter. And I was one of his speechwriters, and I flew on that plane with him when we lost. That these are issues that become so emblematic. But in this case, it's not just an emblem. It's the main question. Do you trust this president as a kind of a Henry V warrior president who's doing the right thing and standing up for the country and fighting terrorism, as he calls it? Or do you see it a man who's been misconstrued? He took us on a crusade off, like the crusades themselves, which were misdirected. They would go off and fight in Vienna. They'd fight in Hungary, killing people everywhere they went. An off-course presidency. And if you see it as an off-course presidency, I think you're probably going to vote for the other guy. Who knows?
Chris, thanks for joining us. Hope you had a good time.
Hey, Mark, and Sue, thank you.
Okay. All right, take care.
Chris Matthews from MSNBC's Hardball.
Still to come, former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Dr. Howard Dean, the countdown to democracy, plus the liberal agenda. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
We're back. It's Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott.
Hey.
Got done with Chris Matthews. That was pretty exciting. I got kind of a contact high from his manicness. I'm pretty manic myself, but it's always nice to meet another one and get all buzzed out. Now, we got Howard Dean coming up. I'm hoping to get a little more juice out of that. I'm a vampire. All right. Right now, we're doing a new segment. It's called the Countdown to Democracy. This is our Countdown Democracy for June 2nd. As the deadline for handover of power to the Iraqis approaches, we'd like to explore various issues and opportunities the Iraqis and Americans will face. Today's issue is, so you've appointed a president, now what? Right off the bat, you've got a problem. Your president wasn't elected. He was appointed by a small group of power brokers. Well, Iraq, America faced a similar situation. In fact, ours was worse because we held an election. One candidate got more votes, and still, we appointed the other guy president. So how do you deal with the fact that the majority of your countrymen do not recognize your legitimacy? Two words. Ignore them. That's what our president did. Hell, that's why we're in your so-called country in the first place. It's not hard. Just keep telling everyone you're in charge, and you will be. And when people start asking tough questions, promise them a tax cut. And if that doesn't work, announce a bold plan to put an Iraqi on Mars. Stay on message, and good luck. This is day 28 in our Countdown to Democracy. Live free or die. Speaking of Iraq, Riley.
Well, where do you want to start?
Let's start with giving Cheney a little probing. I'd like Cheney to be probed. Why does he need to be probed?
Well, he needs to be probed because there is an email that was obtained by Time magazine and reprinted in this week's edition from March of last year, March 2003. This is a Pentagon email that provided evidence of a relationship between our August Vice President Dick Cheney and the contracts gotten by his former employer to rebuild Iraq. And, of course, we're talking now about Halliburton.
I've got the text of the email. It says, we've got it all. We're in.
Have a
Keep
nice
this
day.
On the DL.
Yep. And clear it with the vice president. I mean, that's the thing that's in the email. We need to and I'm paraphrasing. We need to clear this with the vice president. We need to run this past the vice president. There's no evidence that they did not do so, except out of Dick Cheney's mouth, because he's now saying, I don't know what they were talking about. Now, of course, Cheney was CEO of Halliburton from 1995 until 2000 when he got himself appointed Bush's running mate. And
he appointed himself, kind of, right? Didn't we talk about that before?
after a rigorous selection process, came up with himself as the best candidate, which I really kind of like, you know.
This guy's been dirty from day one. Everybody knew that it was all rigged and he was in on it. I just wish that they could make something stick to one of these bastards so somebody takes a fall. No one's taking a fall for nothing. They should probe him.
Well,
Lautenberg wants a probe.
Lautenberg wants a probe. Leahy wants a probe. They say that this email shows clear evidence that the vice president's fingerprints were on that contract. Now, the other problem, of course, is that the Congress of the United States, both houses, are controlled by Republicans.
Bastards.
Dick Cheney's party. And Senator Frank Lautenberg, a good friend from New Jersey, has asked the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee to subpoena those emails and get to the bottom of this whole Halliburton-Cheney-Iraq thing.
Uh-oh, you know what's happening now? Cheney's calling Scalia. Buddy,
yeah,
buddy,
right?
Time for another hunting trip.
Well, the chair of the committee is Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, and she says that a probe by her committee is unnecessary because it's already being investigated by the General Accounting Office, defense auditors, and the Pentagon Inspector General. Now, the problem with that is that in the House, Congressman Henry Waxman of California says he wants to know. He's written Donald Rumsfeld a letter.
Yeah.
And said, hey, you know what? It sounds like your fingerprints are on this. So how do you have the Pentagon investigating the boss of the Pentagon?
Yeah, and they're doing that now, too. They're having internal investigations with Cambone as well, too, right? The Pentagon.
They have internal investigations of everything.
But what the hell difference does it make?
The whole nine yards. Well,
if they're investigating themselves.
Because they want people to believe that they, you know, that, A, that the fox can guard the hen house, and B, that they actually have some interest in getting to the truth in all this.
I just wish this email had come out a year earlier before, you know, a lot of the kind of mess in Iraq and some of the, you know, that Halliburton really wasn't properly accountable in many of the activities over in Iraq because it just, you know, got away with basically corruption and graft and fraud because it was a no bid contract. I mean, I wish this had come out earlier. It would have been, you know, a lot.
Yeah, that's
a lot
important.
Of things could have been avoided in Iraq.
It's important that you mention it was a no bid contract. They didn't go to, you know, Chevron or Shell.
Who wants this deal? Oh, just you.
Just you. Yeah, it's only you.
What a coincidence.
Now, the duty of this committee, the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, is to quote, and this is according to www.senate.gov. Study the efficiency, economy, and effectiveness of all agencies and departments of government. That would seem to include, for example, the vice president's office and the Pentagon. Now, again, you know, most vice presidents are seen and not heard, but Dick Cheney seems to be pulling all the strings.
Heard and not seen much.
Yeah. So what we're asking our listeners to do is to contact Senator Susan Collins' office at 202-224-2523. That's 202-224-2523, let her office know that you want to see these emails investigated. Also, the Committee on Governmental Affairs Office, 202-224-4751.
Give him a call. Tell him Cheney needs to be probed.
Probed.
And probed now. And you know what baffles me, or not baffles me, but I'm always amazed at, like, what's Bush thinking, you know, in all this? I mean, where does he play into this? And, like, he just seems like he's completely kept out of the loop. Hold on.
I'm sure something will pop in my head here.
Yeah,
there you go.
the degree to which kind of special interest groups or campaign contributors have access to kind of government contracts is a very serious problem.
Oh, yeah. And you know, this is the whole notion of kind of like, you know, pay to play. You know, you contribute a certain amount of money to a presidential campaign or to a politician's campaign. And then when issues that concern you or contracts that you might want come up, you get not necessarily, you know, a first dibs like Halliburton, no bids or any of that. But you certainly have access. You're certainly one of those in line to say, hey, I contributed.
Yeah, here's my ticket.
People gotta pay attention.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, I mean, the whole premise of this war was really to pillage and to consolidate the global oil supply under the banner of a select few people, several of which happen to be in this administration or have those tickets that you talked about.
Yeah,
they bought tickets to the big world ownership ball.
They're going to stand to make a whole bunch of money when they leave government. Watch what happens to Cambone and the rest of these folks. Whether they're forced out or whether they leave, they'll all be rolling in six or seven figures due to some of these deals that are being made.
Ken, did you say Cambone and Rumsfeld?
Cambone, Rumsfeld.
How dare they?
Exactly.
Those guys, not as much money as the guys who can go into the kind of oil and energy lobbying and consulting and make money for the, you know, big industrial money.
Well, that's where they're going.
Cambone will go into
Cambone will go into the lobbying business, just like Steve Largent walked out of Congress and walked into the internet lobbying organization.
How about General Karpinski? Do you think she gets a military commentary slot on the TV show? Doubt
she's
it.
The Daily Show, maybe.
She's going to get a monogrammed whip. Liberal Agenda coming up next. And also, we're going to talk to Howard Dean. We'll ask him if Cheney should be probed. How about that?
Yeah.
Right here on Air America Radio. Forty-five past the hour. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition. I'm here with Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott, and Air America Radio. Joining us now by phone from Burlington, Vermont, is former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Howard Dean. He's the founder of Democracy for America, a grassroots organization formed to defeat President Bush. And tomorrow he's speaking at the Take Back America conference in Washington, where he'll be receiving the Tom Paine Common Sense Award. Good morning, Dr. Dean.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you. Hey, what do you think? You think Dick Cheney should be probed for his grease in the wheels for Halliburton?
Well, it appears like he should.
Yes.
You know, he flat out denied that he had anything to do with Halliburton. Here we find the spectacle of the Vice President of the United States of America apparently putting pressure on people in the Army Corps of Engineers and others in order to deliver a contract to a company which he still gets paid by.
I know, it's unbelievable.
If the Republicans in Congress don't investigate this, I think we need to revive the special prosecutor law. You know, we've got what may be corruption at the highest levels of American government. We haven't seen this since the Nixon administration, and something needs to be done about this.
Do you ever get the feeling that they're just going to go, you know what, no more laws, it's all ours now?
Well, you know, there's been a tendency towards that. And,
yeah.
It's pretty disturbing, and I think it's time we took the country back for ordinary people.
What is that? What does the Take Back America conference hope to accomplish?
Well, this is a growing gathering of progressive Americans. I spoke at it last year. And it's people who just want common sense back in their government again. You know, there's no reason for us to continue to be the last country on earth in the industrial world that doesn't have some kind of health insurance guaranteed for every citizen. There's no reason we shouldn't be investing in early childhood instead of building more prisons 20 years later.
Yeah.
And these are things that are just alien to the culture in Washington, particularly to the right wing, which is now in control of both the courts, the legislative branch, and the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Dean, you and John Kerry, while you were on the campaign trail, were very, very critical of each other. And it seems recently you've gotten quite close. You've sat down. I think you've met on certainly more than one occasion. You've been on the road, in fact, together. And I'm curious, do you feel that your supporters, some of whom were equally critical of John Kerry, will come out and enthusiastically support him in November?
Well, I hope they will, because there's going to be one of two presidents after November. One is going to be George Bush, and the other is John Kerry. And those are the choices. And so anybody who's thinking of voting for Ralph Nader, I think, would be making a terrible mistake. You know, Ralph, I don't understand why he's running, to be honest with you. He's contributed an enormous amount to this country. He's single-handedly, in some ways, responsible for some of the consumer legislation, some of the environmental legislation, most important legislation that we've had in the last 40 years. But if he convinces enough people that they shouldn't vote for John Kerry, that they should vote for him, then he will again throw the election to George Bush. And the country can't sustain that. It's a terrible penalty for all those people who don't have health insurance, who don't have jobs, who see their public school systems crumbling. There's an enormous difference between John Kerry and George Bush, and anybody who says otherwise is making a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Howard Dean, could you give us quickly a roundup of some of the topics or the things that you'll be hitting your audience with on Thursday afternoon in your speech?
Well, first of all, I'm going to lay out the agenda for Democracy for America, which is to take back the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has been becoming increasingly ineffective because we have neglected the grassroots for the last 20 years. What we do is to make sure that candidates run for every office, no congressional seat should go uncontested. We also try to get people to run for local offices. In some ways, these tactics were very successfully used by the right wing, and we need to get ordinary people running for office again in order to take the country back. We have 600 people around the country running. And we'll back candidates that we know are unlikely to win, because if we don't spread the message, I was just campaigning in Utah, for example. Well, Utah is a tough state for Democrats, but if we don't spread the message, in places like that, we have no chance in the long term to build the kind of stable coalition that we had for so many years that governed the country with some kind of sense.
Hey, Dr. Dean, we got to cut for a break. We stay with us so we can come back to this. Thanks a lot. We'll be talking more with Howard Dean, Governor of Vermont, and we got the liberal agenda coming up after this on Air America Radio. Good morning. We're coming in for landing here on Morning Sedition. I am Mark Maron. I'm here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. We have Governor Howard Dean, MD, on the phone. I got your article sitting right in front of me, Dr. Dean, about electronic voting. It's a column, yes. Can you comment a little bit about, because you know, we've had many discussions here about these Diebold machines and about these electronic machines that have no paper trail. I guess we can all assume that we're pretty suspect of this administration to the point where we don't assume that it's beyond them to fix an election with bad voting machines.
Well, they did that once in Florida. I don't think they deliberately set out to fix this, to wreck the voting machines, but I think that they certainly deliberately set out to make sure African Americans were disenfranchised. They had a private company from Texas come in to disenfranchise felons
from Texas
rolls. but it turns out that 85% of the people they identified were not felons. So a lot of African Americans went to the polls in the November of 2000 in Florida and discovered they weren't voted and they'd been taken off the rolls inappropriately. The funniest story that I heard about that, which is really horrible, but it's sort of ironic, is that a woman who was running the registrations in the elections got the list of people who were felons, and she was on the list. She was not a felon, needless to say. So she realized that. But anyway, so they did it in 2004. They set out to disenfranchise African Americans, knowing that African Americans voted Democratic largely. Mm-hmm. And what's happening now is that these voting machines don't work properly.
Right.
And so the question is, will the same crew of people who deliberately and inappropriately removed people from the voting rolls in Florida in 2004, will they do that again in 2004? And I think you do have to be concerned, but we know that the machines don't work properly.
And they're easily hacked into, or not hacked into, they can be tampered with as well.
They
right?
can be tampered with on purpose, but they're also likely to fail. And the problem is, once they fail, there's no way you can recount the votes. There was a voting in a small county in Florida in this past primary season, and there was a 12-vote margin, so there was an automatic recount. They found that 134 ballots did not count. It's pretty unlikely somebody went to this vote for the purpose of casting a vote and then deliberately cast a ballot that didn't count. So they did a recount. Well, the way you do a recount is you just look at the ticker again.
Right.
Because there's no way of tracing who did what. So what we want is these voting machines to be disqualified, and that voting machines ought to be required to have a paper trail, and I believe they ought to give you a receipt so you can look at it and see that the machine tallied who you said you voted for.
It's you're saying a recall like across the country, not some sort of legislative thing, just like these are no good for anybody.
That's correct. The Secretary of State in California has already banned these voting machines because they're so inaccurate. And the problem is we've had one presidential election in 2000 decided by the Supreme Court, which opted not to do a recount. I think not doing a recount is always a mistake because it undermines people's faith in democracy. And now we have a series of machines that are made by a company whose chairman is a Bush Ranger, big fundraiser for the president. And these machines are not up to snuff. And my greatest fear, which is actually, from the point of view of a Democrat, worse than having George Bush elected president, is that people really won't believe this is democracy anymore, that people don't believe their votes count.
Right, right.
I think that's a disaster.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Dean. Could you hang out for one second? I think that we've got our liberal agenda coming in. This is from the Streisand compound. It's the marching orders for today. Get your notebooks and your pens. One, Here we go. Call Julia Roberts. Register her unborn twins as Democrats. Two, demand that D-Day ceremonies include women and gays. Three, offer acupuncture to terrorists suffering from missile launcher shoulder strain. Four, be sure to visit new Disney attraction. Barbara Streisand's It's a Small World controlled by oil companies and big business interests after all. And five, remake Knight Rider with special gay nonviolent hybrid car. Dr. Dean, thank you for being a good sport. Thank you for talking to us. It was sure great having you on the show.
Thank you very much.
You
all
bet.
Right.
Dr. Howard Dean.
Yeah, we have a laugh, that laugh on tape. That's the good liberal laugh.
Got to put that in the machine. You should put that laugh in the machine.
Howard Dean's laugh? I don't know if it was maybe all right.
Yeah.
I don't know if people would recognize it.
I should have asked him about. I wanted to ask him about the right wing's criticism of how passionate the left has become.
That's what they call him, crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all about kind of demonizing, making it seem as though it's kind of inappropriate and outrageous. Same thing with Gore the other week. Why can't liberals have strong opinions and go out there and be passionate about them?
Why can't people be excited
without OxyContin?
And without hate. Is really the issue, is that they're so focused and narrow-minded in their bullying and their hatefulness that, that's a very specific type of energy. But when people are trying to be embracive and call question, without the hate, they'd say, that's crazy, all that humanness.
Embracive, that's a good one.
We see them as opponents, they see us as meat.
Embracive. Did I make up a word?
Yeah, it was a good one. It was perfect. Okay, abrasive and embracing in the same tone.
There you go. Coming up on tomorrow's morning's edition, we'll get a live report from Iraq as the new government tries to get on its feet. Plus, you know him, you love him, you couldn't coerce morality out of some people without him. The man behind the myth.